My question is it possible to meaningfully address climate change without significantly altering the way the global economy currently functions?
No. We need a very substantial transformation if we are to win the battle against this crisis. And it is the most significant transition we have to undertake. Do it everywhere and do it walking on two legs, reducing emissions dramatically and adapting to a changing climate. So it is a huge, huge agenda, and 2021 is a key year for this transformation. Why? Well, the pandemic actually made us all a bit more humble. And I hear it from many people reevaluating what really matters in life. Well, our health matters. Guess what? If we allow climate change to continue the way it is, there will be more diseases. With rising temperatures, we will see more pandemics.
Welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. I'm Bruce Edwards. If the global pandemic has proved anything, it's that people and institutions need to adapt to change. IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva was invited by the Albright Institute at Wellesley College to discuss how the fund is adapting today and how it's changed since the institution was created in 1944 to support the economies of the post-war world. Joseph Joyce, Professor of International Relations in the Department of Economics at Wellesley College, was the moderator of this conversation with Kristalina Georgieva.
Questions come up periodically about the need for a new Bretton Woods system. And maybe I should say very quickly, Bretton Woods is the name we use to refer to the agreement that was made in 1944 at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, not too far from Wellesley, by the 44 representatives of the Allied countries, looking forward to the post-war world. And they set up a new monetary system and also started the IMF as well as the World Bank. So that's what Bretton Woods started with. And so the question sometimes comes, is there a need for a new Bretton Woods? And as part of that, how can the fund persuade countries to do what needs to be done, to do the changes which you are very eloquently putting out need to be done? How much can the fund induce countries to make those changes?
I went to Bretton Woods for my birthday this last summer because I felt I wanted to get into this history of how in the midst of a war, our founding fathers, they, by the way, were all fathers, 44 men, had the wisdom to establish institutions for post-war reconstruction. Now we are in a similar kind of Bretton Woods moment. We have to reconstruct, we have to rebuild from the hit of COVID-19. And at the same time, we have to transform our economies to be greener, to be fairer, actually to be digital everywhere, so everybody has access to this digital transformation. So we do have a new Bretton Woods moment in that sense. Does it mean we have to create new institutions? I actually, not because I'm in one of them, this is not self-preservation. I see these institutions having evolved with time, doing what needs to be done today to protect the world economy from significant harm. If we didn't exist, if we didn't have the World Bank, the IMF, and other institutions, the world would have been in recession that would have gotten deeper into depression. So we would have had yet another Great Depression. Why? Because we would have lacked these transmission lines of policy assessment, policy action swiftly. You realize that the world has poured $20 trillion to put the floor under the world economy. And monetary policy accommodation has allowed businesses to survive. Unemployment has gone up, but not to dramatic levels. So I would argue that element of resilience for the world economy that comes with these institutions is precious. We have to value it, and we have to continue to develop not only the Bretton Woods institutions, but also the other elements that keep the world connected and effectively coordinate action when it is necessary. If you look at the IMF today, we perform the heart of the global financial safety net function very differently than we did it in 44. But we do perform this function. And I would be preoccupied and insistent on continuing to build these institutions for tomorrow. Where we, and this is probably the thing, the question that gives me most sleepless nights. The question is how in a rapidly changing world that is geopolitically very different, more fragmented than it used to be, how can we keep our membership together? How we can crystallize objectives that generate unity and also action on a scale that is necessary. So far, the fund has raised to the occasion, even if we would be a bit kind of meandering, losing direction, especially at the moment of shock, the fund always would step up and then change so it can remain effective. And also what I see is a tremendously important need for cooperation among the multiple institutions that is, one, driven by purpose. If we are to say that the world today has three priorities: bring the health crisis to an end everywhere, transform, recover, and transform the economy for the future, not replicate the economy of yesterday, and prevent divergence between rich and poor people, rich and poor countries. Each and every institution has to find its place vis-a-vis these priorities and deliver its utmost best to address them. And for me, that is our new Bretton Woods moment, to step up to what is expected from us in this crisis.
Kristalina, you mentioned a little bit your own previous work. And of course, you grew up in Bulgaria when it was still a communist country. And you were there when the communist regime ended. And we're curious to know, how does that affect your perspective when you look at issues such as the ones we're talking about today?
Well, you know, the most important value of this personal experience for my job at the fund is that I know firsthand the price people pay for bad policies and the benefits of good policies. My country basically went bankrupt as a result of bad management of our economy. We then got into an incredibly difficult couple of years in the early 90s after the collapse of the centrally planned economy. In these days, I had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and queue to buy milk for my daughter. And I saw how my mother's lifelong saving melted to nothing because of hyperinflation. And then the country took on board prudent policies. Up to this day, Bulgaria is immune against borrowing willy-nilly and squandering money into white elephant type of projects. During this crisis, we see Bulgaria being one of the countries that have handled the economic impact of the pandemic fairly well because of strong buffers and strong finances. So I bring this experience to the fund, and it is both an understanding that there is a pathway to sound macroeconomic framework, but also having the empathy for people that are, for very often no fault of their own, experiencing the negative consequences of bad policies, and how this transition to sound macrofinances can be managed with attention to social needs, so you don't pull the plug on your education and health expenditures. You guarantee that as a result of adjustment, when this adjustment is necessary, the country is getting better off, but the most vulnerable, the poorest people, are not left out. They actually are a center of attention. And if I may, we are now living through a very unique crisis. To go back to your first question on the value of these institutions, if we needed to be vindicated for being part of the global landscape, this crisis gave us an ample opportunity for that. The fund assessed the crisis very quickly and came up with unorthodox policy advice. It basically said, spend, keep the receipts, but spend. You don't hear an IMF managing director saying this word, spend, often. We did that because it was the right thing to do. Now we are talking about calibration of support at this stage of the crisis. And then we stepped up very, very rapidly crisis finance directed to especially the most vulnerable countries. We have funded some $105 billion since the beginning of the pandemic, benefiting 83 countries. 49 of these 83 countries are low-income countries. And this is where we made the biggest difference, by significantly increasing our concessional lending capacity to provide lifelines where they're most needed. And I can say it was my upbringing, but even more so, having served as a crisis commissioner and learning what it is to anticipate a shock, and when the shock comes, to act decisively.
Well, speaking of that, not only does the IMF and you talk about the crisis to do what we need to do now, which you've just outlined, but I know you've also talked about the world after the crisis and how things will change. And in particular, you said that the crisis has triggered profound structural transformations of national economies. And you said that governments have to be ready to aid in the transformation of those economies. So I wonder if you could tell us which sectors of the economies may prosper, which economies may not, may actually contract, and what type of policies do you see governments with the backing of the fund enacting?
Well, thank you for this question. What is very clear, just a year into this pandemic-induced crisis, is that digital, broadly speaking, tech, big winners of the crisis. You and I have no problem to do our jobs, and we are part of this privileged segment of the economy that can operate remotely. Digital services overall, digital currencies, they're all taking off very rapidly. I used to say that the future is digital. Well, the future has arrived. We are in it. Automation and manufacturing that is based on that automation, big winner. Where are the losers? Contact-dependent industries. We saw what has happened to restaurants and services of all kinds. Travel. There are some who say the convention tourism is dead. I wouldn't go that far. I think it is going to eventually recover to a certain degree, but we sure are not going to go back to where we were in the pre-pandemic world. Low-skilled workers, women, young people, these are the segments in societies, country after country, that are most severely impacted. And broadly, if I talk not about the sector, but about an issue, the issue that is going already is hitting us and would hit us even more, deepening inequalities because of this K shape that we see in countries and across countries. I am particularly concerned about the K shape across countries. After decades of progress in convergence between high income and low income countries, we are hitting the reverse gear. We are seeing now divergence that, if left unattended, would not only harm tremendously those affected, the countries that are affected, but it would harm security and stability in the world as a whole. So there is hugely important priority on recognizing this diversion, some doing very well, some doing very poorly, rapidly and substantially revamping our tax policies, moving towards more redistributional system of taxation. So those that are doing very well, help the rest, reshaping public spending policies. So we think more about building resilience, not just to the pandemic, but resilience to shocks. And what it means is invest in resilient people that are educated, healthy, with sound social protection when necessary. Resilient planet. We have now a climate crisis that was knocking on the door before that has gone nowhere that we have to deal with. And of course, continue to build the resilience of our financial system. As you know, Joe, we did some of it, actually quite a lot of it, after the global financial crisis. We built more resilient banking system, but that is not enough. We have non-banking institutions that have been left off the hook. And of course, we had this whole holistic view of resilience for a world that is going to be more shock prone because it is a faster changing world.
So, Kristalina, as you know, the Albright Institute is designed to take young women at Wellesley College and expose them to global issues. And for that reason, we ask global leaders such as you to come and address them. So, Kristalina, thank you so very, very much for joining Wellesley College today.
Thank you, Joe. It was wonderful to be with you. And to everybody who was on the line, stay well and never, never, never aspire for less than the best you can be.
I'm sure Matt Albright would second that one very quickly.
Thank you.
That was Wellesley College Professor Joseph Joyce in conversation with IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva at the Albright Institute for Global Affairs. You can watch the entire event on the Wellesley College YouTube channel. And go to imf.org to find more conversations with Kristalina Georgieva, including her talk at the Center for Strategic Philanthropy at the University of Cambridge. And look for other IMF podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe if you like what you're hearing. You can also follow us on Twitter @IMF_podcast. Thanks for listening.